Welcome to Pemba On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare, career development, and healthcare leadership topics. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries, most of whom graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. We hope you will take full advantage of these practical, insightful, and relevant discussions designed to help physician leaders get new and build upon existing leadership skills and perspectives. Hello. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Nicholas Wells and Monica Jones to Pemba On Demand. Monica and Nick are physician leaders in the Erlanger Health System in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Dr. Jones is a CMO at Erlanger East Hospital, and Dr. Wells is the Associate Medical Director of the NICU at Children's Hospital in the Erlanger System. Nick received his MD from the Uniformed Services University back in 2006, and in addition to practicing as a neonatologist, Dr. Wells has also served as the CMIO for the Education Research Training Directorate at the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center for nearly 2 years. He's also a certified Epic Builder and has responsibility for the Ortocept build and EMR implementation in the NICU since 2021. And he assumed his current role as the Associate Medical Director for the NICU back in 2019. Nick is currently enrolled at Pemba in the class of 2024. Dr. Woods received her MD from Indiana University School of Medicine in 1980 and has completed an anesthesia residency and fellowship in obstetrical anesthesia. She worked as an anesthesiologist from 1984 until 2019, serving as an assistant professor of anesthesia at Baylor College of Medicine for 6 years. In 2019, she accepted the CMO position at Erlanger East Hospital in Chattanooga. Monica completed her MBA at Pemba in 2011. Today, Nick and Monica are going to be sharing with us about a project they initiated to improve neonatal and newborn resuscitation at Erlanger. The initiative focused on improving safety in the OR for infants following delivery by C-section. So the title of our show today is Enhancing Newborn Resuscitation Spaces, a Quality Improvement Project for Safety in the OR. Welcome to Pemba On Demand, Nick and Monica. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
So before we start the discussion about our topic of the day, I was wondering if maybe we could talk a little bit and have you share a little bit with the audience about your experience with Pemba at the University of Tennessee. Nick, I know you're currently enrolled. Monica, you attended back in 2011. But I wonder if maybe, Monica, you could start by sharing with us your primary motivations for pursuing an MBA at that time.
You know, over the years, you see decisions being made that you wonder, was there really any physician input on this decision? And I think in the past, many times, physicians, we've been so busy taking care of patients that we haven't sometimes stepped up to the hospital to be involved in what decisions were being made. And so one of my goals was to be able to have that involvement as a physician and also representing the rest of the physicians at the hospital in those questions. And inviting their input to me when decisions are being made. That was really a big factor for why I decided to do this. I've also, in my anesthesia group, had leadership responsibilities that I wanted to learn more behind the scenes at the hospital and how it ran, how decisions were made. And so those were really big decisions why I wanted to do this.
Great. Thank you. Nick, how about yourself? What was your main factor for pursuing your MBA at this point in your career?
So I joined Erlanger in 2019. And as you mentioned, prior to that, I had spent 17 years in the Navy, where I learned a lot of leadership skills, leadership qualities. That's kind of what the military is known for. But I got really zero or limited teaching education on sort of the business side of things. In military medicine, a budget is sort of an imaginary thing. There's always a budget, but the numbers don't mean the same as they do on the civilian side of things. When I came to Erlanger, I didn't know how to bill or effectively capture charges. I just really didn't know any of the business side of how a nonprofit was run, for example. And I just really had a fascination with executive medicine and how, you know, with COVID hitting and how hospitals were able to stay afloat, it just kind of piqued my interest on the business side of things. And so that kind of led me to exploring options for, you know, how I can get that education to learn about the financial side of running an effective institution.
Great. And another question for you, Nick, did you look at other advanced degrees, such as a master's in public health or a master's in health systems administration?
I did. I looked at both MPH, MHA. MHA. And I just, in looking for the different options, I kind of came across PEMBA, and that I reached out to Tom, and he was great. And he answered all my questions really quickly. And I liked the format of PEMBA. I like the sort of the combined in person, the combined sort of the resident periods with the at distance learning, and the more I thought about it, I like the curriculum better than the other degree programs too.
Now, at the time that you signed up for PEMBA, did you know that Monica, as the chief medical officer in your organization, was a PEMBA alumnus?
I did not know when I was reaching out to Tom. I didn't know that she had completed it at PEMBA, but I did reach out to her before I made my decision, because Tom gave me a list of graduates who were in the Erlanger Health System, and I recognized Monica's name right away, of course. Reached out to her. She was very helpful in answering the questions, and my biggest concern was, how much of a time commitment is this, and can I still work full-time and do all my duties and get them done with a timely manner? And so that was a big impact on helping me make that decision, so...
And how about you, Monica? What about, did you consider other advanced degrees before you decided on the MBA?
You know, I really didn't, unfortunately, but I'm being very glad that people I knew had done MBAs, and that was how I came to my choice. Also, a big decision for me was the fact that PEMBA was a one-year program. Yes, for 1 year, you're going to work very hard. But it was a one-year program, and that was a big thing for me.
Yeah, I think that's something that really sets the University of Tennessee's PEMBA program apart, is that they managed to – it's a very intense curriculum, and there's a lot of work that goes with it, I found, when I was going through. But I did appreciate the fact that I could complete it in 1 year. I had tried to start other programs, and it seemed like something always derailed me from completing them. Because in the second or third year of the training, there was always some crisis that came up that made it much more difficult for me to continue to work on the projects and to make time for the classes. So I appreciated the fact that it was a 1 year sprint, so to speak, and that you could accomplish a lot in that year.
I also liked the fact that it was all positions, and that it was so directed towards, as a physician, what I was interested in medicine, in hospital administration, or in running your own business, if that's where you are, that you could take it that direction.
So I know these questions are probably going to be a little more difficult for Nick, since he's in the middle of the program. But I wonder if Nick, if there's been anything in the first quarter of your program right now that you are already starting to realize was something, a benefit that you really didn't anticipate?
I think the biggest benefit that I've seen so far is just the networking that I wasn't even thinking about prior to the program. But one of the current students is the medical director at Le Bonheur for the NICU. And so there's two of us neonatologists in the group, and we've already collaborated several times on various things. In fact, he's helped my OAP. I've been able to sort of mimic something that they're doing there for that. And so, and even working with my cohort has been great. I've got some great individuals in my cohort that's, we've been in communication pretty much from day one. Once we found out we were in the same group, we worked together for our projects. We bounce ideas off each other. And so, and there are different specialties, anesthesiologists, the surgeon, we've got a hem-onc physician. And so the ability to meet these individuals all across the country, because I was actually surprised how many different locations came to this program. I was assuming it would be mostly people from sort of within a two-hour radius of Knoxville, but we've got Saudi Arabia representation. We've got all as far as West Coast, Northeast. And so students are coming from all over, and the ability to network them has been really eye-opening.
So Monica, how about you? What value did you find from Pemba that you really didn't anticipate?
Well, as strange as this is going to sound, it was really the respect of other physicians that I had done the program and that I was working to represent them. That was really probably the most unexpected result of doing the program.
Those were physicians, your colleagues that you were working with in your anesthesia practice?
Yes.
And as a corollary to that, what did you find the biggest impact on your career was after completing the MBA while you were working in your anesthesia program?
You know, it allowed me to look at, once again, at a different viewpoint from the hospital side. As we talked about contracts, areas they wanted, what they wanted from anesthesia, about how we meet both sides' needs. And I really was very surprising to some of my partners that it allowed me to look at it from that direction a little bit more intensively.
Did that result in opportunities within the group that led to more leadership opportunities that ended up in the opportunity to become the chief medical officer, or were those two disconnected?
Those two were disconnected, but within the group, it did allow me more leadership opportunities. When our hospital brought Epic up, I headed up the anesthesia section for their anesthesia part of Epic for our department. So yes, it did allow me more leadership roles.
Great. And Nick, how about you? Have you noticed any impact on your career yet from being enrolled in the MBA?
I wouldn't say I haven't seen anything yet. I'm pretty busy and pretty involved in the program and what I'm doing at Erlanger already. So I'm trying not to tell too many people I'm doing it quite yet until I get it completed, but I haven't noticed anything yet.
All right. Thank you very much for sharing that information. I think at this point, I'd like to kind of move into your presentation. As I've been talking with you, Nick and Monica, I've been really excited to hear this. And obviously, Nick, you forwarded the slides to me, so I had a chance to kind of go through it. But I think it's going to be a great presentation. So I will turn it over to the two of you.
So thank you. Yeah, so this project was a kind of a backstory here. So this is took place in our level 2 NICU at Erlanger East. And it's a very robust delivery service. We have more deliveries at Erlanger East, which is where our level 2 NICU is, than we do at our main hospital, which is where our level 4 NICU is. And so we had a lot of C-sections that happened here at Erlanger East. And one of the main issues that when we first came to Erlanger East as a new group for Erlanger was that the OR setup was very impeding for the neonatal resuscitation delivery team, and that myself or the NMP, whoever was on NMP's cover at night, the NEO's cover during the daytime, the delivery nurse and the respiratory therapist were sort of compacted into a 2x3 foot space behind the anesthesia equipment. And that's the way it was for years prior. And that's the way it was when we, the new NICU group arrived at Erlanger. And it had, some concerns by myself, by several of the other providers, particularly our vertically gifted providers who are much taller and need more resuscitation space. It really, kind of affected their ability to provide safe and effective, resuscitation for our neonates. And that kind of got the ball rolling as far as let's think about some ideas. And so that kind of explains some of the background. And so another part of the equation was the parents also had a very difficult time being engaged and involved in the resuscitation of our infants because the anesthesia equipment was sort of the way it was set up. And I'll show a slide in a few slides that kind of describes better the design of the OR layout. But the parents, once baby came out, baby was brought around the surgical field. So some of the problem in the background here, we'd had didn't have enough space for the neonatal resuscitation team. Another issue was our parents had poor visibility. They couldn't see their infant or their child after the patient was, after the C-section, the patient was brought over to the NICU warmer. Again, we were kind of tucked away behind all the anesthesia equipment. And so the parents couldn't see their baby, and that affected obviously patient satisfaction, but it also, if we had a bad delivery, or we had a patient that was chest compressions or required intubation or epinephrine or anything, you know, required during NRP, parents were not really involved. They couldn't see. And so if I wanted to kind of get them involved, update them, I kind of had to shout over the anesthesia equipment. So there's obviously some safety and efficacy concerns there. Kind of started the process. Okay, how can we improve this, both from a patient safety and also a patient satisfaction? And so, again, in the current situation, the OR was not set up for optimized, effective neonatal resuscitation. There were spatial limitations. There's also a risk of contamination. So after the patient was delivered, oftentimes when patient was stabilized, we let dad kind of walk around so we could take pictures, see the newborn. But current setup, the father had to walk all the way around the OB's surgical equipment, around the anesthesia equipment. So there was a risk of contamination. Again, parents had very poor visibility. And all of this together, really, the patient safety component was really the biggest driver. And we had, looking back, you know, that now we had over 10 eSafe submissions sort of outlining this unsafe working condition, unsafe working environment. And again, eSafe is our version of a patient safety report that can be inputted by really anybody who works at Erlanger. And so we had a number of concerns, not just by us, by other people that were working in the OR, that this needed to be fixed. And so that's kind of where this project took hold. And this, like I said, this took about 3 years to complete. And there was a number of things that contributed to that. We had some change in leadership. We had a CEO change. We had a change in the director of quality. We had limitations sort of on financing for this project. And so it took a number of years to be completed. But when we started this, our goal, you know, our smart aim was to remodel the L&D operating room to support neonatal resuscitation and reducing our eSafe complaints by, you know, 50%. Realistically, I've always felt that once we were able to complete this, we would probably reduce them by 100%. But obviously that's not a realistic goal. So we kind of picked that 50% reduction and then increasing parental satisfaction by 20%. And this was sort of an outcome that we were looking at sort of post hoc, so to speak, after that we completed this project. Looking back, I wish there was probably better ways we could have assess this. And this was mostly looking at Press Ganey scores. And we kind of chose that just because it's something that we already have for our parents to utilize. It's a standardized evaluation system. And I just thought it doesn't quite pinpoint the process improvement that we completed, but I felt like a goal would be to improve our parental satisfaction in those Press Ganey reports. And then we completed this in December 2023. And so our SMART AIM completion and outcome goal was December 2024. And then our outcome measures and our process measures, I've kind of already touched on those a little bit, but our balancing measures, I think, is something that's a little bit different. I look at a balancing measure as if when you're completing a process improvement project, you know, you have your goal, sort of you have your goal in mind, but how does that affect other people, other departments? And how can you monitor for that? And so how will this affect your obstetricians with the orientation of the OR that we're changing? How would it affect our anesthesiologist with the equipment being changed? Yes, our goal was to improve safety, but how are we going to monitor that? Are we going to obviously watching and keeping track of our eSafes as we completed the project from the get-go to make sure we're not seeing an uptick in that? And then how would it affect patient flow and workflow? Would this slow down our OR efficiency based on the changes to the OR design? And also, of course, how that would affect the OR turnover. And so that's where I was at with the balancing measures.
Next slide.
This was our cause analysis. Not to go too much detail, but our problem statement was limited OR space, effective neonatal NRP, and had suboptimal parental visibility. And you can look at all the different things that kind of affected this fishbone. So, you know, when our initial designs of moving anesthesia equipment, moving gas, restructuring where we had the Pyxis in the OR, you know, how would this affect compliance? Would this be allowed? How would this, did we have the appropriate gas outlets to make this work? The environment, obviously, you know, we were affecting the OR, but would this affect other structural components of the OR if we were changing where things were going to go in the new OR? Budget, obviously, this is a big component of this project. You know, we originally, our original estimates that we put together were about $250,000, which was never really rejected per se, but it was all, but it was sort of brought back to the table. Okay, how can we make this for less, essentially? Obviously, our process was to improve our space, improve our parent visibility. And then, you know, how are we going to measure this? And so looking at our safety outcomes, our press gaining scores, one component I haven't mentioned, but how is this affecting our staff? You know, with our NEOs and NMPs, there's a lot of stress from this limited working environment. And this was a key driver for why we wanted to make this process work. And it brings us to our key driver diagram. You can see all of our interventions there to the right. Our key drivers were enhancing safety and functionality, improving patient our parent satisfaction, improving our workflow efficiency and staff satisfaction, and then, of course, effective communication and team coordination. With a better setup, our goal was to allow the different departments to communicate and work better together, all with a goal, smart aim of remodeling the OR to cut safety complaints by 50% and raise parent satisfaction by 20%. And so kind of cut to the chase here. So this is to the left is our initial OR before the process started, and to the right is our final outcome. And so I've highlighted in red and green the neonatal resuscitation space pre and post renovation. And kind of walk you through the workflow here. So that bottom right door there is how we come in after walking through the area to scrub our hands and clean. We come through, we'd walk sort of around the end of the patient table, the sterile field, and we kind of cramp back behind all the anesthesia equipment there to the area highlighted in red. The prior OR setup, we only had room for one warmer, and so we were limited to just singleton berths. And you can see, you know, we having three people there was pretty much our max occupancy during a resuscitation. Our code cart, if we had to bring it in, obviously sort of limited any more people coming for resuscitation. And then, like, you can't really see here, but the head of the bed there with the person is the primary person with just resuscitation was really limited for about 2 feet with the anesthesia equipment behind them. And so limiting their ability to intubate sometimes, or even have room to maneuver around for if they were switching out from giving chest compressions and providing PBV. And so what we did was we were fortunate in that the OR lighting was updated during this time, which allowed us to kind of move the patient table really 90 degrees there. You can see to the right there, we were able to move that table, and then we were able to shift all of the anesthesia gas from the wall top of the image there, all the way to the opposite wall. And that allowed us to shift all of the anesthesia equipment down sort of in front of that door to the bottom left there. And we were able to open up all that space there. You can see highlighted in green for the NICU resuscitation team. And you only see one warmer in that picture there. But we had enough space that we actually have two warmers now. And we've actually been able to resuscitate twins in this OR, which wasn't one of our initial goals. But once we were able to do the renovation, we realized we had so much space. We actually had enough space for two warmers. And you can look at the table there now, and that's the head of the table is supposed to be the dad sort of sitting there or to the left there of the table. You can see now he's got a perfect direct line of sight to both warmers. And so once baby comes out, they actually, instead of the OB having to walk all the way around the equipment to drop the baby off at the warmer, now the baby is just essentially dropped off. The obstetrician or the resuscitation team who's handed the baby can basically just turn around now 1 or 2 feet. Drop the infant off of the warmer, and we can begin a resuscitation. And so you can see we gained invaluable space in this upgrade. And so Again, we completed this project in December of 2023. It was really guided by our multiple e-safes that were submitted. The redesigned OR has definitely enhanced our resuscitation and also has enhanced parental visibility. It was a cross-department collaboration. This took a lot of buy-in from anesthesia, from really even the obstetricians, and we were able to address all the workflow concerns from both departments before we began the build. It did extend beyond our initial timeline, but we were able to complete it despite having limitations in budget and leadership changes. At the end, we were actually able to complete the entire project for a little under $10,000. So it essentially saved about $240,000 from the initial estimate. And that was primarily by using in-house resources and also sort of thinking outside of the box, so to speak, by not changing the gas as much as just rerouting some of the wires or the cables to the gas along the top of the OR. And so again, we saved a significant amount of money in the process. It wasn't our goal, but it ended up working out in that way. Lessons learned, the importance of hospital safety feedback systems, PSRs. I've never really been a fan of these systems, but this is one of the situations where, multiple inputs of e-safes really helped push this project to completion. I think it really helped leadership understand the importance of this project. Having stakeholder engagement is key too. We really did a lot of preemptive work with both our obstetricians and our anesthesiologists to get this project underway. And their buy-in really made this a really easy project once we got the green light to complete it. And then really adapting to barriers. This was a very large OR. It was uniquely designed and it had four separate entrances exits. And so it limited what you could do with it, but we were able to adapt to both cost limitations and space limitations that really helped this project get completed. So next steps, again, continual stakeholder engagement, obviously making sure that the obstetricians, anesthesiologists are satisfied with the setup, make sure they're addressing their concerns. And of course, the Prescini scores and eSafe monitoring, the design optimization, which we've kind of looked at. We know we're able to put twin warmers in there, which has been sort of one of the unexpected bonuses of this project. And then developing this model for sort of future OR designs, sort of thinking about the parent visibility, thinking about the ease of getting the patient in and out of the OR for future ORs that we may or may not design.
Thank you. That was a great presentation, Nick. Thanks very much. This podcast is sponsored for you by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, at the Haslam College of Business. Are you interested in pursuing an executive MBA and ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country? In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development that is not found in traditional medical education or medical school curriculums. Please join our nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates. The PEMBA program and its network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates may be the right choice for you. Visit our websites for more information about the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. You can also visit the website to find out more information about the PEMBA On Demand podcasts and live streams. The links to the websites will be included in the show notes. A couple of questions as you were doing the presentation. You mentioned this is a level two NICU, and you have a level four NICU at another facility. How many C-sections do you respond to in this OR annually or monthly?
I think Dr. Jones may have a better knowledge on that number. I know that we typically have, I think we have around 5,000 deliveries per month at East, of which about 20% you can estimate would be C-sections. And so it's, 5,000 deliveries a year, of which about 20% would be C-sections. And so I'm not sure what that math comes out to being, but we have multiple C-sections per day. We usually have on the books two or three scheduled C-sections. And of course, you have usually two or three more C-sections per day on top of that. So I would say somewhere around 5 to 8 C-sections per day on average would be a ballpark.
So I have a question that I'm going to ask Monica in just a minute. But Nick, can you tell me what the size of the performance improvement team or the process improvement team was that was working on this, the number of You mentioned the stakeholders before. I just wondered if you could share with us how many different people were engaged in this work.
Yeah, sure. Great question. So there was about two or three of us from the NICU department. That includes the nursing medic, the nursing director, myself, medical director from our level four NICU was involved. From anesthesia, we had the lead CRNA and the lead anesthesiologist on board. Probably two from OB, and then probably two or three from the OR staff as far as the overall involvement. So I would say about 10 that were sort of in constant communication regarding this.
So Monica, I know that Nick mentioned during his presentation that there were several significant leadership changes in the organization. And I wonder if you could share, as the chief medical officer, how did that impact the ability of the team to get permission to move ahead? And did it result in any delays for the project while new leaders were being brought on board?
Well, we lost our director of quality during this time. And he actually was really quite good in helping, but when we looked at the layout of the OR, it just was not going to work because of the surgical lighting. It has single arm that would not allow the surgical light enough distance from its base where it was mounted in the ceiling to make the change. But during this time after he left, we had to get new surgical lights, which had a dual arm. And then when Nick came, he kind of brought the whole thing up again. And we had us to relook at it all. And that's when we realized that they had put in the new surgical lights. And I think one of the things that really was key to making this work was we got everybody together in the OR at once. We didn't just meet with nursing now and someone else then. We got everyone together at once. And we presented this possibility. And as we presented it, you could just see the lights going on in people's eyes, kind of like, oh yeah, this could work. And each department then, as we were in the OR, I said, okay, put together the list of what you need done for your changes for your department. And then our next meeting, that list had been taken and divided by departments for who was needed to do that section. And we then, all of us, met with engineering and IT. And our engineering department was very instrumental in getting this accomplished. And I have to give them a huge thank you. But then we only had 2 days. During those 2 days, we shut down that one OR, which meant we had to take an OR from the main operating room in case we had any times where we were going to have two sections necessary. And they were very useful and are very helpful in cooperating with us doing that. So there was a lot of people involved in this that you don't really necessarily think about. We didn't do any scheduled sections during those 2 days. IT and engineering and construction got all the changes done in 2 days.
Did you have any emergency sections in that day that your planning sort of paid off? Dividends for you?
Well, we had one operating OR, even when the second one was closed down. But there wasn't any times that we had to take a second C-section to the main OR.
So you avoided any kind of overload just fortunately during that time. But you did have a contingency plan in case you needed to have a second section going at that time.
That is correct. And that was an important part of this.
Was there another question for you, Monica? Was there a specific project champion? Was Nick the project champion, or was there someone else in the OR or another neonatologist, Nick, that you appointed as project champion for this to kind of shepherd this through?
I think it was Nick and I, both of us, truthfully, because, you know, when the OR was built 30 years ago, this hospital was supposed to have low-risk deliveries. Well, you and I both know what that means in a hospital. And during that time, we grew from a small number of deliveries to about 300 a month, 275 to 300 a month. And so those changes came with time. And as those changes came, the necessity of improving the neonatal capability to care for these newborns also grew and necessitated these changes.
Great. Thank you, Monica. Nick, one of the questions that I had for you, I noticed with the key that driver diagram and the Ishikawa diagram or the fishbone diagram, those are common tools to use in lean projects, Six Sigma, and I know that the University of Tennessee is quite big on lean, not just in their PEMBA program, but they have an aerospace MBA and they have other MBAs that really focus on lean. But where did your exposure to these tools come from? Is this kind of the standard improvement methodology that Erlanger uses, or had you had exposure to this in the military, some other background?
I had exposure both in the military and at Erlanger. I don't know if it's an Erlanger-wide process improvement project style, but our prior medical director, Dr. Sinha, he was very big and involved in QI projects, and that's sort of his methodology, and that's kind of how I learned that project style. And so I've always liked the way it kind of highlights and outlines important parts of a QI project, and so that's why I kind of chose that methodology. But Dr. Jones may be able to answer more if that's more of an Erlanger style as far as QI projects, but that's just how I learned in the military and here. So,
Monica, could you answer the question a little bit, whether Erlanger has a specific commitment to Lean or Lean Six Sigma as their project improvement methodology?
We have in the past used Lean. Now we're doing the PDSA cycle at the present time for quality management. But we have used Lean in the past. The new PDSA kind of came when we got our new director for quality for the system about 3 years ago.
And I've seen some lean management textbooks and lean management experts who really take the PDSA cycle, you know, back to Deming and back to Schuhart, where they talk about it being part of a lean approach as well. But a lot of times I notice that they don't always use exactly the same tools that I was trained on when I was learning lean. So I think some organizations see it as the same and others don't necessarily. But I wonder too, if you could talk a little bit, Monica, about, we know that tenure of CEOs and people in healthcare organizations is somewhat short. I think the average CEO is between 3.5, the average CEO tenure is between 3.5 and 5 years, according to some studies that I've read. So the fact that you managed to have a little bit of a hiatus when this project was first set up and then it finally got some momentum again and you kind of reorganized the team, I think is very generalizable to other organizations. But could you specifically talk about some of the lessons that you think would help other organizations as they start to see improvement projects stall out because new leaders come in with different initiatives, different priorities? I think it's a significant problem that I faced in my roles in various healthcare organizations.
You know, having been at Erlanger now for 34 years, you see a number of CEOs, CMOs come through the system. And you have to realize that every time you have a change in higher management, if you have a project that you're trying to get started, you're basically going to have to start over many times because they come in with different goals, different perceptions, and you may have to start over in introducing this new person to your project. You may feel like you've taken a few steps back, but it's a matter of just starting to bring them up to date on this project. And CMO or CEO, they may have different priorities for what they see as the priorities for their projects and to have to deal with that. And dealing with change at higher levels is very challenging when you get a new person to see how to work with them and to accomplish what you need to.
Thank you. Nick, one of the other things that I noticed about the project is specifically there weren't any specific financial measures for the project. And I wondered if there was any pushback or any challenging that you had to face as you rolled the project out to address that particular issue?
I think Dr. Jones is shielded from a lot of the information regarding the financial limitations. I never felt that way. I never felt like we were being pushed to complete the project with a certain price tag. I think leadership understood that the potential benefit from preventing just one Sentinel event would make the price tag sort of a moot point. So I never felt constrained by the cost of this. And because relatively speaking, even the initial price tag of $250,000 is a very, I feel like, a modest size project for the potential patient safety impact.
I agree. Yeah. I think that for an organization, that's not a significant investment based on, well, you just went through an Epic implementation, and I'm sure the price tag of Epic implementation was much more significant than $250,000. But I guess the follow-up question, you talk a little bit about your measures that you're measuring, you know, the outcome measures process, the balancing measures. What would you say the biggest impact or one or two of the largest impacts that the team has already noticed? It sounds like the two warmers in that space gives you a lot of added comfort and security, right, to be able to manage twins in that area. Are there other things that the team has noticed that are really, really obvious already?
I think one of the things that surprised me was one of the feedbacks I got from a few of the providers was how close the parents were now to them. Almost that was took an adjustment to be able to do effective NRP, but also have parents about a foot behind them as before. You kind of were shielded from them. And so it's learning to become more comfortable with resuscitation with parents being so close. I didn't even think about that when I started the project, but it is. It's something that I think made some of the providers uncomfortable, which wasn't one of my, anything that I was even measuring or concerned about, but it was feedback that was given me pretty quickly. But they've adjusted, and I think parents, and you know, it's one of the things that as a physician, we have to do a lot of things in front of parents, especially in neonatology. We're doing sometimes chest compressions and intubating patients with parents standing over our shoulder. And that's something that we've, you know, a skill that we've acquired over time. But again, it never makes it easy, but it does allow parents to be involved with this, especially if it's going south and patient's not compatible with life, and you can get parents involved in that resuscitation. So it's a good thing, but sometimes it does take physicians getting out of their comfort zone. So,
have you had any feedback from parents about how they feel about being close to the resuscitation?
I have not had any specific feedback yet, but I definitely had feedback prior to this how it was difficult for them to even see their patient, to see their baby, for the father to walk around. Oftentimes, we wouldn't even let the father walk around because we didn't have room ourselves. And so we definitely got feedback prior to making the changes. But now I think a lot of parents expect this. And so we may not see that feedback, hey, this is a great idea, because they would have assumed that, you know, their experience would have allowed them access to the baby after delivery. So
great. Well, thank you very much. This has been a great presentation. Monica, thank you very much for taking the time out of your Sunday to show up and to be on the show. I really appreciate your input.
Thank you.
And Nick, thank you very much for putting this presentation together. I think this is going to be a very valuable podcast for us. I think that the physician leaders can learn a tremendous number of lessons from the project that you two did at Erlanger, and I really appreciate you both taking your time. So Nick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And so that wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to another PEMBA On Demand. Thanks very much to Nick and Monica for sharing this project with us. I'm sure that you all were able to take valuable lessons from the discussion, and I look forward to hearing feedback from you. Thank you also to Kate Ashley and Don Leiter and Tom Brown for their support for this program. Without them and without their support, we certainly could not make this a successful podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you, and we're really happy to answer any questions that you may have. I will also add a link to the website below in the show notes. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player of choice. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. Also, please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck in your future. The Pemba podcasts are released bi-monthly on Thursdays. Each live stream is recorded and also released as a podcast. We also have guests and content in addition to the content presented on the live streams. Episode 11 of Pemba On Demand will feature Dr. Michael Fromke, a 2022 Pemba alum, presenting his supply chain improvement initiative and discussing its impact on improving the financial health of his organization. Episode 12 will feature Dr. Edward Millemeyer, a 2006 Pemba alum. Ed will be discussing his career as a physician leader and his many different roles in various nationally recognized healthcare organizations. He will also be describing his current focus and his passion for his latest role. Another 2006 Pemba alumnus, Dr. Camilo Gomez, will be our guest on episode 13, discussing optimization of urgent endovascular stroke interventions using a Lean Six Sigma approach. Be sure to catch our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Overcast, Pandora, or Spotify. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel at Pemba On Demand. You will see our live streams and recorded podcasts available there.